Welcome to the Late Set from WRTI. I'm Josh Jackson.
I'm Nate Chenin.
What's going on, Nate?
I am so excited about our guest this episode.
Yeah.
Because I think of Mark Turner as a giant among us.
He is.
He's, you know, he's one of those people who really changed the language. And I think it's so subtle that it can be easy to miss. But I honestly think that any musician learning how to improvise and how to be fluent in the jazz language in our time has to contend with Mark Turner.
You can consider a number of saxophonists especially. Mm-hmm. Ben Wendell, Melissa Aldana, Walter Smith III. These are all people who have clearly had to listen to Mark and sort of take his language to create their own.
Yeah.
And that says something about an artist. You know, it's like Charlie Parker. Everyone is still working on him.
Right.
And John Coltrane.
I think about that famous Charles Mingus quote, you know, if Charlie Parker were a gunslinger,
there'd be a lot of dead copycats.
But Mark has a, if Mark Turner were a gunslinger, I think there would just be a bunch of well shot up targets. He's a peaceful man, is what I'm trying to say.
He is definitely a peaceful man. He doesn't, he's not shooting anyone.
And there's a moment in our conversation where I bring up the people who have emulated him, and he's, you know, very typically gracious on that point. He's not somebody who's looking out for credit.
It was so interesting to see him in that California backdrop.
Oh my God.
You know, no more Brooklyn. And I'm so accustomed to seeing Mark really at the Vanguard, at the Village Vanguard.
Yeah.
I mean, I have seen him at other places, at the Montreal Jazz Festival with Kurt Rosenwinkel. I even saw him at some small place once with the guitarist Gilad Hexelmann. Mm-hmm. But I generally, most of my experiences with Mark have been very intimate and in the Vanguard, hearing that music.
We've talked about the Vanguard as a sonic space before, as yes, a sort of temple of listening. And there's something about the dryness of that room that so perfectly suits the dimensions of his tenor saxophone timbre and sound. You know, it's like, it's funny actually that he's recorded so much for ECM because his tone is, I just think of it as like, it's low gloss. It's like matte finish, you know?
Eggshell.
It's very dry. It has a subtle grain, you know?
Yeah.
Very expressive, but very little in the way of ornamental qualities. You know, it's kind of like right to the point.
So Mark's new recording, Pattern Master, comes out on ECM next Friday. So we've got an exclusive here.
Yeah.
On the Late Set.
And, you know, this is the latest in a series of, you know, Mark Turner quartet recordings. I'm not sure if I made enough of a to-do about it in our conversation, but I think Lathe of Heaven, the album that he released in 2014 with, you know, a different drummer and a different trumpet player. But I think Lathe of Heaven is one of the great albums of the 2010s. I mean, top five, probably.
It's one to be remembered and will be.
And so this one is a sequel of sorts, but it is reflective of, you know, a bunch of new preoccupations for him. He's a really thoughtful composer. He's the kind of composer bandleader who arrives at a point after puzzling through a series of sort of self-made conundrums. You know, he's really into challenging himself.
And like they described Coltrane as an incessant practicer, mm-hmm, I can vouch for Mark being that, because when we did concerts and recordings at the Village Vanguard and Mark would participate, he would be there all day.
Yeah.
Playing, working through something that's something to practice on. Mm-hmm. He practiced no matter what.
Yeah, for sure. I just want to acknowledge that we are coming off a year, 2025, in which Mark Turner did a whole bunch of stuff.
Like quietly prolific.
Oh my God. Quietly and not so quietly.
Yeah.
So he delivered a fantastic performance on Steve Lehman's album, The Music of Anthony Braxton, a quartet album with alto and tenor saxophones, bass and drums, one of my top albums of the year. Mark also released his own album, The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, on Giant Step Arts in the fall. And this was inspired in part by the James Weldon Johnson text.
Yeah.
And Mark engaged with it very thoughtfully. He also... He also did a solo recording. Tell us about that.
On Jakob Bro's label, Loveland Music, I think is what it's called. Mm-hmm. And it's called We Raise Them to Lift Their Heads. I remember listening to this and thinking, boy, this really feels like me in the Vanguard listening to Mark work it out.
And there's at least one more thing. There's probably like a dozen more things, but at least one more notable thing. I wrote liner notes for this one. The Billy Hart Quartet's album, Multidirectional, the first ever live recording by that band. And this is a long-running group with Ethan Iverson on piano and Ben Street on bass. And of course, Jabali, Billy Hart on drums. We talk about that in the interview. But I'm making the point here that, you know, this man is just very productive in a number of different modes and modalities. So we focus on the new album, but there's always something else cooking.
Well, let's get to business. This is our conversation with Mark Turner here on The Late Set. Joining us on The Late Set is saxophonist and composer Mark Turner, who for many decades now, I guess we can say so, has been one of the leading lights in this music. And Mark, it's always a pleasure to have you in conversation, no matter when or where it is. The new recording, which is coming out March 13th, is called Pattern Master, with trumpeter Jason Palmer, bassist Joe Martin, and with Jonathan Pinson at the drums. First of all, thank you for joining us here on The Late Set.
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah, it's awesome. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be, in company with all the other people you have on this show.
Mark, are you, in fact, the pattern master?
No, I am not. I wouldn't say that's a little much. No, Pattern Master is actually Wayne Shorter. Yeah.
Tell me why.
Pattern Master is one of the books in a series written by Octavia Butler. And it's part of the Patternist series. And a Pattern Master is, I don't want to go too into it, but basically it's a psionic individual who, in the future of humanity, when human beings have more ability with their minds, Pattern Master is the one that holds the pattern. The pattern is a mental pattern for all the rest of the human beings in their realm. So this group of people they're not very many of them, but that's what the Pattern Master is, someone that sort of wields his or her force above and beyond all the others and influences everyone else in their region. That's what Wayne Shorter is.
Yeah, inarguably, that's what Wayne Shorter is. There's kind of an encoded tribute to him on that title track, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Could you explain that for us?
Wayne is a huge influence on modern music, not just jazz, but I'll say primarily jazz. Compositionally, instrumentally, harmonically, rhythmically, in terms of form, rhythm, all kinds of things. So that's all. It's just saying that he has a huge influence on modern music, and without him, the music that we play now would not be the same. Those that influence people, even without them realizing that they're influenced by him, he has that kind of influence.
Mm-hmm. I'm noticing a trend, I guess, of science fiction coursing through your recent works. And with The Lathe of Heaven, with Return from the Stars, and now with this. And in addition to Octavia Butler, I think it also talks about maybe your interest, if I could be so bold to inquire, in sort of the limitations of humanity. Some of these books are rather dystopian, and yet, you know, this is this is sort of a quartet of creative artists contributing in some sense that we often sort of describe as not limited in some ways. But I'm sort of curious to hear your perspective on it as someone so deeply involved in these science fiction theories, and how it may or may not even apply to your band or your music.
Yeah, I mean, loosely speaking, so, you know, science fiction is, oh, by the way, as you probably all know, Wayne Shorter was also a sci-fi fan, right? That's another nod to him also. But anyway, yeah, the thing about sci-fi is that at least good sci-fi or speculative fiction, so sometimes it's not always science-oriented, is that in combination with world building, it uncovers some aspect of humanity you wouldn't otherwise be able to reveal unless you created a situation where basically something that doesn't exist now, or something that's, let's say, exaggerated, something that's possible now, but maybe not as in the forefront of our experience. So it might be AI, or it could be, you know, a situation where who knows what it could be. It might be a dystopian world where the climate has changed, or who knows. But, and in those situations, then something about human nature is exposed and either solved or exposed, or some kind of introspective nature into it. Anyway, that's what sci-fi does, or reveals in a way that, I'll just call it, I don't know what, normal temporal prose. I don't know what to call it. It's difficult to reveal because you're involved in a situation that we know. The only time maybe that's uncovered is historical fiction or something like that. Basically in a situation where that's different than the experience that we live in. How does that relate to the music that we make? I don't know. Maybe one thing I would say is I think that most artists, I'll include myself in that, are trying to create a situation that's enchanted beyond ordinariness that people come into. Could be music, could be literature, could be dance, could be theater, cinema, cuisine, architecture, whatever it is. We're using art, something physical, something that people recognize. So you recognize flavors and tastes, we recognize sounds, we recognize sights, body movements, so on and so forth, to pull people out of their ordinary experience and to experience something else that they wouldn't normally experience, so they can reflect back on their own experience and leave the room another person.
When I saw the title of this album, initially I missed the literary reference and I thought more directly about musical patterns, you know?
Sure.
And it made me think about... Mm-hmm. What at this point is multiple generations of aspiring improvisers who go to conservatory and spend countless hours transcribing your solos.
Or many other people's solos, but yeah, I understand.
Yeah, yes, lots of different people. But specifically, I think we can safely say that there's a lot of Mark Turner emulation happening in these settings. And I say that not to embarrass you, but because I know you to be a supreme craftsman and someone who is constantly working on your expression. And I wonder how disconcerting it is, you know, to sense and then to see evidence of people who are maybe losing the forest for the trees, but really, really trying to get at something that you've done or something that you've articulated. What is your experience of that?
Honestly, I don't pay attention to it that much. I think I hear more about it from sort of a reflection like yourself, or other people will tell me that it's true. I don't say the saxophone player checked you out or something like that.
Yeah.
If I could go back to my 20-year-old self, yeah, of course it's a compliment. It means that I've maybe gotten to a place that I never thought I would get to.
Are you yourself paying a lot of attention to patterns as you write and as you practice?
Actually, there's a student that I came to study with me and he only asked me about patterns. And I thought that was funny because I thought about it and I said, actually, I actually try to avoid patterns. I really want to improvise, and improvise meaning take ideas and find variations and continue to make more and more variations, so on and so forth. and discover, try to find places I haven't found before, but without falling off the surfboard, if you want to call it that. Anyway, he asked me about that, and I looked at my book. I usually have study books, and I do have lots of patterns written out, but I only use them as a practice tool, just something to get something in my mind. I heard this thing that Warren Marsh said once that, you know, I didn't know that the Tristana School practiced patterns, but they actually had them. Some other guy that studied with them, I read about it. And he said something about learn the patterns and forget them. I totally agree with that. I sort of always do that anyway. It's just a tool to get something in your mind. Why? Because human beings like, you know, I think we as a species, we like repetition. We like patterns. We like to eat dinner at the same time. We like celebrations at the same time of year. We like to wear summer clothes at certain times of the week. Okay, basically, I think most people like to know that certain things are going to happen at a certain time. That's how we learn. That's how we generate belonging. That's how we generate all kinds of things in human experience that we expect. On a macro level of music, I think that happens also. Even when you're improvising, there are patterns. If you don't fall into the trap of playing them all the time, which becomes licks and things like that. Same thing with writing music. If you can see those patterns and find variations and find ways to continually change them, that's what makes a great story, right? You start something, you might say something musically or in literature, whatever, and the person listening to it, kind of like the blues, actually, it's a short version of that. So you say something, somebody expects you to say it again. You say it again, but it's a little different at the end, right? You say it again next time, there's another variation. If you keep saying the same thing over and over again, then people lose interest. Anyway, long-winded explanation. Patterns are important as long as you pay attention to what the patterns are and how you use them.
That was all very interesting information. It spurred a thought, which is to sort of draw it back into this sort of world of speculative fiction and the idea of pattern recognition and machine learning versus sort of cognition in a human and sort of neural networks at work are two very different ways of associating with patterns. And I wonder how much of that thought did you apply into the fact that you're four humans working within the construct of a composition that you've written, but at the same time, there is this space for something that I don't know that a machine would learn.
Yeah, I hear you.
It's sort of like a predictive outcome versus surprise, Mark.
I think that machines will probably get there, though. I think they're starting to get pretty close.
Oh, no.
Maybe he's not already... in jazz, but that's what I'm thinking about. But
you're already living in a post-human environment. Okay.
Yeah, maybe. I think humans can use, especially in music, music is a little bit like math. It's like math with narrative laid on top of it somehow, something like that. I don't know. I think the more that we could use that aspect of our minds, at least in music, that I think often music gets, it can be more satisfying. In fact, someone like Wayne Shorter, who seems like, you know, he's maybe might seem like a, I don't know what the word would be, maybe the opposite of a logical thinker in music. But if you check out his compositions, they're very logical. Really, it's pretty uncanny and it's amazing how logical they are and full of, I don't want to say patterns, but very logical variations and harmony and melody. Anyway, I just want to make that point. I think sometimes, for example, students will think that someone like Wayne Shorter is just pulling things out of the wind, but it's actually quite the opposite. Anyway.
Yeah. And even the mystery, there's so much mystery in his music. And then you realize how carefully plotted and constructed.
Carefully constructed. Yes. It's incredible. Thank you.
talked about patterns. Can we talk about texture a little bit, Mark?
Yes, sounds good.
Yeah, I mean, I'd really like to get your perspective on, you know, the four of you sort of creating an acoustical event, as it were, the timbral qualities of this unit, and how would you describe the texture of this band and this music?
You guys have may have heard that Steve Lehman record that came out. Maybe not. I don't know, but
Anthony Braxton.
I was just thinking about that.
What we're doing is the opposite. There's a wider dynamic range, wider tonal range, dynamic range. So soft, hard, medium in terms of dynamics, in terms of rhythm section and the horns. So I would say that's the what I'm thinking about. Why? Because to some extent, I think that's where most of these instruments, in particular horns and bass speak and those ranges. When you get to the F to triple F, there's only so much that, okay, drums can do a lot, but drums doesn't have harmony. All they have is dynamics and timbre. So they can express themselves more with a wider dynamic range.
And, you know, you mentioned that Steve Lehman Band, you have a track on this album called Lehman's Lair.
Yeah, that's him.
That's him. And it would seem also to be maybe a callback to another tune of yours from way back, Iverson's Odyssey.
That's right.
You know, yeah. Like the tune that is fondly named for a collaborator. But let's talk about Lehman's Lair and what you are encoding in that, you know, that speaks of Steve Lehman, you know, and your partnership with him.
There's a tune, I forgot the name of it, but one of his tunes that has a melody that is not singable for most people. So I wanted to do the opposite. So just a melody that's very simple, very singable. You could just sing it while you're walking down the street at the same time with some complex harmony going on. So there are a lot of key changes and stuff. All you have to do is sing it and you can hear the harmony. So I was just trying to make something that's opposite. So one part the same, one part the opposite of his tune.
I'm glad you said that too, because that melody on Lehman's Lair is probably the most singable melody on this album. I can imagine having that tune pop up into my head.
Yay. It worked. All right, I succeeded.
Are these exercises for you, Mark, to sort of, how can I increase the cognitive load on everyone?
Whoa, sorry.
No, and still, but still present it in a way that people can remember it from a familiar melody.
Yeah, to some extent. I'm glad that you've expressed it that way. I couldn't do that. You just put it in a nutshell. There's some truth to that, yes. Why? Because, you know, I feel like that's what the masters did. You know, think about Charlie Parker. That's what he did.
Give me a for example. Tell me.
Well, okay. A simple melody, I don't know, but there are plenty of examples where I think he learned how to play fast melodies and make them lyrical. Learned how to play complex harmony. It's really the beginning of modernity in jazz anyway. And make them singable, something that, you know, even if you don't understand what it is, you can walk down the street and sort of sing it or sort of feel the outline of the melodies. I think of him as an example. Same with Wayne Shorter. He put all these singable melodies, super complex harmony. A lot of those tunes, you can just sing them and not realize there's all this stuff going on underneath the melodies. Anyway, there are other examples in other people, but yeah. Train. Sorry, I'll use Train again. Train is somebody who... Miles Davis, another one. Train is somebody who took, again, complex harmony and made it more accessible. So records like, you know, Love Supreme. That's pretty complex, pretty hardcore. I think there are a lot of people who don't know anything about jazz. And if you just put on Resolution, great. It's got all this power and intensity, complexity, and somebody would feel, oh, this is a killing jam. Let me just listen to this.
I see that you revisited Super Sister, which is something that you recorded with Jeff Ballard and Larry Grenadier, the Fly Trio.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Why the new hairdo? Why the revisit?
That's funny. Revisit was because, partly for practical reasons, also because I noticed that I'm just going through, how can I put it? There's a few things. One is that just listening to all the great composers, jazz composers, and then the European masters, I'll say, just listening to them, noticing that they will revisit their own past, other tunes that they've written, maybe within, you know, maybe they wrote a melody or a certain part of something or a certain voice leading section in a previous symphony or a string quartet or something, and they'll put in another piece that they wrote later on. I realized that actually a lot of composers recycle material with variations a lot. So, and that, you know, that goes for jazz composers as well. And I thought, well, I felt that was another way for me to rediscover or understand composition more, is to revisit things that I've already written and change them, change the key. In this case, there's a key change. There's an added section. There's a modulation. So that's part of the reason, just for composition's sake, just to learn about that. The other one is that I thought it would work well with this band. I felt like I liked the version that we played with Fly, and I thought, okay, maybe with another voice, the harmony would feel even more clear. Maybe the tune would have some kind of more forthright strength and all that. The band is different, drummer's different, bass player's different, so I thought might be a good prospect for this band. So that's basically why.
Mark, as you mentioned revisiting, it makes me think about a year ago or so when I saw you at the Village Vanguard with mm-hmm. the Kurt Rosenwinkel band.
Oh, yeah.
From right. The Next mm-hmm. Step, which, you know, was a really consequential
back
album.
To the 90s.
And it was really something to hear that material again and to, you know, bask in the rapport that all of you have together. But it also raises this question for me about the Next Step was one of a series of kind of markers around the turn of the century from your mm-hmm. peer group saying mm-hmm. like, hey, we are coming out of the jazz tradition, but we're going to do this our way. Like this is like a new articulation of something, you know?
Sure.
And, you know, 25 or so years later, I wonder how you take stock of that. You, Kurt, Jeff Ballard, Brad Meldow, like, you know, all of you guys are mm-hmm. now in your 50s. You have a certain stature in the music, and you've certainly had an influence. And I just wonder about what your perspective is on that shift.
Oof, that's hardcore. I don't know what to say about that. Yeah, shift in what way, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, the shift in your perspective, really, you know? Like, because there was a sense back then that you guys were all kind of looking to carve out a space.
Sure. Yeah, that's true. We were.
And you were successful, I would say. And then some, mm-hmm. you know, like you've all explored beyond what you even could have imagined back then. Now you can kind of look in the rear view and say, this is what I was thinking then. And this is what what I really cared about. And like, here's mm-hmm. how that has changed for me.
There's a lot of things that young musicians, I think, now take for granted that, at least in the 90s, aesthetically didn't go together. A lot of people play straight eights now. It's also become straight eights in the sense that it's almost like a new version of fusion now. Very acoustic sounding straight eights playing with complex rhythm or complex harmony, coming from that duple kind of playing instead of triple kind of playing, swing as opposed to straight. Those things we were working on then, and now those things have stayed. playing with a certain kind of pop sensibilities, melodies that you can sing, especially Kurt Rosenwinkel tunes and Brad tunes too, that, you know, feel sort of like pop music, but have complex harmony or rhythm, or at least an acoustic sensibility. That didn't really, that existed before, certainly, especially in Wayne Shorter or somebody like Herbie Hancock and others. We were trying to figure that out in a way that we could do. That part has lasted too. There's a lot of people that write tunes like that now, almost too much. Sorry, I shouldn't say that.
No, you won't find disagreement on that point from us.
You know what I'm saying? I'm just kind of like, man, can we just, you know?
Yeah.
You know, some people will check that stuff out and I say, you know, maybe listening to Brad or whatever, like when Brad mixed straight eights and rock and all that stuff, mm-hmm. among other people. I feel like, you know, a lot of that micro work that we were doing is, that's what lasted. Mm-hmm. We didn't know how it was going to manifest. I didn't know how it was going to turn out, but that's what we're just trying to, on a molecular, atomic level, whatever, figure things out. I think we felt like, or at least I did, you couldn't make huge changes like a massive rhythmic change or mm-hmm. harmonic change that might have been done in the 60s or something like that. That stuff's already been done. That's already been mined. But you can do, I don't know what, genre mixes. And yes, time was one of the things that maybe hadn't been mined as much. So I would say, for example, you know, if Steve Coleman had never existed, all the stuff that has happening now would never have happened. Okay, maybe someone else would have done it. But that needed to happen. And we were finding our way to incorporate that in the straight aheads, you know, modern mainstream, whatever you want to call it, scene. So anyway, those things have lasted and changed and morphed. I think if you check out music of the past, pay attention to what's going on in the present, you create the future. If you leave one of those out, the future will not be created in any lasting, substantial way.
We can't let you go without asking you about another really wonderful association and a working band, which is the Billy Hart Quartet. A lot of history now with Jabali. And you and I talked last year for the album Multidirectional, which I think is just a tremendous statement. But can you reflect, as we're talking about this sort of continuum of the music, can you reflect on what it's meant to you and what it's done for you as an artist to have this long-running association and collaboration with Billy Hart?
I wouldn't be where I am without Billy Hart. He's like been like a musical parent or father to me in ways that he doesn't realize. If you use it, I tried to use it as best I could. It definitely, a laboratory sort of sounds, antiseptic, but a place to figure things out musically, especially with someone who came from and played with people, including himself, that I am trying to emulate and respect. Part of it is on a oral literal level, meaning you play some music with someone like that, you're trying to figure it out. How do the eighth notes feel? How does the time feel? How does the language feel with someone who plays straight eights or swing like that, or with a certain ride cymbal, or with their bass drum, or that's the macro level. That's how I figure things out. Some people don't. I need to figure out all the trees. And by doing that, then there's expansiveness from that. Then I could see the whole forest from it. Also to see how someone like that, I think, has the same artistic musical ethos that I want to have. You know, he's totally rooted in the tradition. He's open to playing in free or avant-garde situations. He also plays super straight ahead. He has his feet in a lot of different places, which makes him, to me, exponentially creative. And he's always interested in learning and takes action on that. It's one thing to be interested in it and you sit on your ass, or you can be interested and take action and say, what am I going to do? And try to play, take action on things that you've learned from people your age, older than you, or younger. He's totally down for all that. So he's sort of an example of someone I would like to be like.
One of the joys of seeing you at the Village Vanguard was to see what you were reading. In fact, that's how I learned about Ready Player One long before it came out.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And I generally like to find out what it is you're reading, and do you have a list of things that people other than you should read, science fiction or otherwise? What are Mark's picks?
So sometimes I go to my brother, who's also a sci-fi fan. I call him my sci-fi sensei. That's speculative fiction. So he tells me what's happening. He told me about this book here. This one is called The Complete Book of the New Sun. Super interesting. It's basically it's about this. It's set far in the future. It's like this sci-fi fantasy mix, but it's not really fantasy. But, you know, it's one of these books where it's set far in the future. Man is gone to the stars and done all these things, but somehow in the present, in that time period, there's a certain regression to the past. It's sort of like a semi-medieval, but then there's the other ones. See, I got to find them. Let me see what I've got here. Ursula K. Le Guin. I'm just trying to finish all that up. There are all these short stories that she wrote. There's one called The Stars Are Legion. Interesting, I haven't read it yet. It's just on my list. 5 Ways to Forgiveness, Ursula K. Le Guin. Let's see. Oh yeah, I finally read Blood Child and Other Stories. It's the last of the Octavia Butler short stories. I hadn't read it, so I just decided, okay, I'm going to complete it. That's all I've got right now. There's some other ones, but I have a list and it's not in front of me. My daughter has this huge list of all the books you're supposed to read. So yeah, basically, when people are making literary references, you kind of know what the fuck's going on. Sorry, but so I'm starting to check that out too. I just want to have an overview, so I'm educated. So that's it. Yeah.
Well, thank you for exploring the realms of human limitation as a creative artist.
And hey, fantastic! I'm all about it.
And giving many others something to strive for, Mark Turner. Come to Philly.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll do some patterns. We'll do some pattern recognition. You know? That means we're all going to sit down together and make a puzzle. Whoa. Good to see you, bud.
Thanks again. Take care. Find many great saxophonists in this music. I don't know that you'll find one who is more well-read and thoughtful and contemplative and kind of like quietly playful than Mark Turner.
Yeah, he's got a little streak in him.
Really enjoy that. You know, I can only imagine what it's like to be on a long tour bus ride, you know, like on the road, just developing inside jokes with Mark Turner as a bandmate. That's got to be fun. It's time for your favorite moment of our show, Josh. This I dig. Shout out to Hank Mobley. Here we go.
I'll tell you what I'm digging, Nate.
Please.
So I've been listening to a lot of East Wind recordings. They are from Japan. And many of them are made here in the U.S. in the 1970s, during a time when a lot of the artists who are featured on these records were probably not getting very many gigs. So I've been listening to, for instance, Seven Minds by bassist Sam Jones.
Okay.
Which is a really hip record. You can find an inordinate amount of recordings with the trio of Cedar Walton, Sam Jones, and Billy Higgins.
Right.
On East Wind Records. You can also find recordings by Al Haig, which a lot of people don't consider Al Haig much these days, on East Wind Records. Really good one also.
And these were made, were they made for the label or were they acquired by the label?
No, they were made for the label. So the Japanese are the executive producers on these sessions that happen, most of them in New York.
Uh-huh.
There's one more that I talked to you earlier about this week, and it's by Andrew Hill.
Mm.
And it's a record called Blue Black. So it's Leroy Williams on drums. It is Chris White from Dizzy Gillespie and Nina Simone on bass, and on saxophone from North Philadelphia, eventually lived in Brooklyn, but from Philly, Jimmy Vass. Now, Bobby Zankel here in Philly told me something else recently.
Okay.
He thinks that Jimmy was Sonny Fortune's cousin.
So, whoa.
Yeah.
All right.
So the saxophone clearly runs in that bloodline pretty well.
And how does this rhythm section and Jimmy Vass, how do they handle Andrew Hill's music?
It's fantastic.
All right.
And it is maybe the funkiest album, or at least Blue Black, the title track, is maybe the funkiest tune that Andrew Hill has ever made.
Mm. Can we expect to hear this on a Friday mixtape soon?
You will.
Nice.
You will.
Nice.
So that's my thing. East Wind Records. Unless you're in Japan, they're kind of hard to find on LP, but they probably reissued this stuff on CD. I don't know if it's streaming, though.
All right. Well, my dig this week is a little bit of a cheat because it will double as coming attractions. But I'm being honest with you that one of the things that I have been digging most lately is the new album by Tomika Reed. And this album is called Dance, Skip, Hop. There's an exclamation point after each of those imperatives. It's such a fun and rewarding album. Springy, and it has a groove. It has, like, you know, melodic point of view. Tomika, of course, is I'm going to come out and say she's our leading jazz cellist of the moment. You know, she is doing all kinds of great stuff. She also appeared earlier this year on Craig Taborn's album, Dream Archive. And so here's the coming attraction part. Tomika will be coming in a matter of days. We will welcome her to our studio, and she will be on an episode of The Late Set very soon. So, just had to confess that when I thought about what I've been digging, there's very little that I've been digging more than that.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. Thank you very much. And if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to leave us a rating on the podcast platform of your choice. And don't forget to subscribe and follow us on all of our social media at WRTI Music. And our email, editor@WRTI.org. Leave us a comment.
The show is hosted by me, Nate Chenin, with Josh Jackson. It's produced by Alex Arif. Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager, and he makes this episode. Our production assistants are Alexander Bolliker, Jacob Dodd, Delia Joyce, and Alana Beltran. Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate general manager for content and programming is Josh Jackson. Bill Johnson is WRTI's general manager.
Stop by WRTI.org and check out everything else that we're cooking up here in Philly and beyond. And we'll see you soon. Bye, y'all.